Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the TCP, the That's Criminal podcast. To start tonight, I made a decision. I'm going to go independent with my next book. I guess I'm technically an indie author now, though I've done it once before with Wraith of Shelter Mount. But in looking at Ty Benhoff's second book, the Overmatch title, I decided I didn't feel like waiting around for publishers to figure out their schedule and make a call on Overmatch, so I did it myself. So I'm going to put Tie 2 out on my own. Gives me more control. I don't have to bow down and give up the title I choose for whatever some publisher wants to do. I don't have to argue over covers. I've got the great Jeffrey Ray Hayes from Plasma Fire Graphics doing another amazing cover. He did Spoilers. He did Wraith. He did Brother's Keeper. Actually, all of them at this point. He's done new covers for all of them. So I'm really looking forward to what he comes up with. And my editor, the brilliant Shelley Peeler, is doing her best to make all the gibberish that I put down on paper sound intelligent. So she's got a big job ahead of her. Shooting for a release in the spring. And as things develop, you guys will be the first to know. And that's it. That's all my admin points tonight. So we can get right into it. I'm very excited tonight to talk to Jillian Lauren about her new book, Behold the Monster, which documents her time spent with serial killer Samuel Little. Jillian is a writer, storyteller, adoption advocate, rock wife, and a lousy kickboxer. I can relate. She's the New York Times bestselling author of the memoirs Everything You Ever Wanted and Some Girls, My Life in a Harem, and the novel Pretty. Some Girls accounts for her time spent in a harem of the Prince of Brunei, and has been translated into 18 different languages. Wow. She was the only journalist to extensively interview Samuel Little, the most prolific serial killer in American history. The experience is chronicled in Joe Berlinger's hit Stars documentary, Confronting a Serial Killer, and in Michael Connelly, one of my favorites, podcast Murder Book, The Women Who Brought Down Samuel Little. Her book, Behold the Monster, came out in July. She has an MFA in creative writing from Antioch University. Her writings appeared in New York Magazine, The New York Times, Vanity Fair, Paris Review, and many others. And she's been in many different anthologies. Jillian is married to Weezer bass guitarist Scott Schreiner, one of the largest playlists in my teenage years. And they live in Los Angeles with their two sons. So in Behold the Monster, documents the time she spent with Samuel Little, from writing letters, gaining a modicum of trust to actually face-to-face interviews, and his admittance of over 93 murders of women throughout the United States. So as you can tell, I'm very excited to have this discussion. So Jillian, thank you very much for joining me.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, John.
Absolutely. Yeah. The bio, I was like, holy crap, 18 different languages. What goes into having somebody translate your work into 18 languages?
Sometimes you work closely with the translators. Sometimes, you just get the book in the mail, from Bratislava. I'm very popular in Eastern Europe. So I've had the chance to travel to some of the countries and meet the translators. It's really been an incredible experience. I really only speak French as a second language, to the point that I could read it and really get any sort of sense of the poetry or language. So, I'm in the hands of the translator, but it is right. An art in and of itself. Yes.
Yeah, it's funny that you're in the trust of this person. It's funny when a translation into 18 languages. I've taught internationally in different programs, mm-hmm. and I remember speaking with one interpreter to my left and another to my right, and talking about, I think we're teaching hostage negotiation or crime scene or interviewing. And you talk, you give them a statement, make a point you're trying to make, and then you hear it translated to either side of you, and you kind of look at the audience and be like, I hope that's coming across. Like, this could go bad if something's lost in translation. It's like, well, I don't speak French afar or whatever they're saying. So it's like that trust is kind of funny. So
that's a different kind of trust. You know, I mean, I'm talking about like artistic trust. You're talking about, you know, trust that the wrong kind of communication could probably do a lot of damage. But not always. I was in Poland at one point and on a talk show, and I had a translator in my ear, and this was, you know, the Polish Oprah. And I have a way, like I have a humorous or conversational way about me or tend to in interviews. And it wasn't reading at all to the audience, because jokes don't really read, and they definitely don't read with the wrong, you know, like they're hearing a translation, I'm hearing a translation, the wrong timing. So it's like everything I said fell flat on its face. And, you know, it was a good lesson for me in communication.
Yeah, like playing the message game, but on live TV in a different country.
Right. And that maybe you should figure out how that's going to work before you jump in and do it.
Right. Yeah. It's like this usually kills in New York. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
your book on Behold the Monster, and looking at your other works, and your journalistic work over time, is this your first kind of foray into the true crime world?
Yes, depending on how you consider my first memoir, several short pieces I've written have been crime related. But in terms of like a long form, I approached this as if I wanted it to be, you know, a true crime reportage. Very traditional for New York Magazine. And of course, I messed that all up and got myself in the middle of it. And, you know, it's become sort of a hybrid of true crime reportage and memoir and some narrative, you know, that's just imagined, though based on heavily researched fact.
Yeah. It's as I'm reading over it, like the thing that comes up to me, and I probably need to set the stage a little bit, and I think this flows into it, but the methodical way or the patient way you had to go about building rapport with Sam Little, I think of, you know, what I know of him and what I've read of him, a guy who had a, you know, 60 year petty crime in and out of jail career, that guy knows how to play to the judge. He knows how to play the parole board, probation officer. He can feed a line to anybody. That's just what criminals learn in jail in the system. But he also was murdering people on the side, mm-hmm. well under direct microscope of law enforcement for most of his life. So
got a great kick out of that.
It's amazing. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, frightening and amazing, but I was wondering if you could kind of lay out how you managed to enter the introductions through gaining trust. And I kind of feel like you had to filter through some nonsense with him probably before you got to the meat of what might have been truth with him. I don't know if that makes sense.
I believe a lot of it was what I got to eventually. And the thing that I had that most reporters don't have is the luxury of time, or not so much luxury, the necessity of time, because how deep I got myself in, you know, took that much time and effort and energy and engagement to deal with. You know, I had no idea this, for instance, the number of victims, you know, the 93 confessions. When I started this and expected it would be an article, the rapport was both a matter of trial and error for me. I mean, like you said, you know, this is certainly my virgin voyage into a full true crime book, but, you know, it was quite a rocky voyage for a virgin voyage. I made it up as I go along. It was definitely the first time I talked to a serial killer that I know of. And it's different. It's a really different thing than any other interviews I'd done before. And the rapport really took that long until, like you're saying, you know, do you know if he was telling the truth or not? I think by the end, yeah. And that he mostly was. And there were a number of reasons all of this happened. It was sort of a perfect storm. You know, was I this magical person who showed up, or did I show up at the right time with a set of skills, with the kind of chutzpah that gets you walking into a men's maximum security prison? Like, all of these things sort of lined up right at about the time all his appeals were done. He was, you know, ready to either go gently into that good night or finally tell his story. Enter me.
Yeah, right. So, so if I have it right, when you first got put on to his case, and I don't, you know, the hard part is you read the book and then you talk to the author and you don't want to give a bunch of stuff away in the book. So it's like, but to set the stage, like, you heard about his story, heard about, what he was accused of, and then just some hook just grabbed you. What was it that grabbed you about this story and was like, no, I'm writing this. I don't care what this monster is. I'm going to go face it. Like,
this is chapter one, so I don't really think we're giving away any spoilers. Also, you know, the New York Magazine article has been out. The thing is, you know, what I think special about the book is how in-depth it allowed me to get, you know, how broad in terms of the science, in terms of the psychology, in terms of the law. That was really exciting about it. But in any case, it is not that much of a spoiler. Like you were saying, Michael Connelly is your favorite. So his newest detective is Renee Ballard, who works with Harry Bosch as well. And I had both the real detectives that Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard are based on in this book. So I learned about Sam Little from Detective Mitzi Roberts. The LAPD, who is Renee Ballard in Michael's book. So Mike was very generous to me, because I, you know, I'm like, I'm going to ask your cops a bunch of questions. Is that cool with you? And he's an incredibly supportive guy and wrote my foreword, has been very supportive. I had a lot of guides along the way, a lot of wise guides. But Mitzi Roberts, and an interview with her about something totally different. I ended the interview by saying, what are you most proud of? I like to, you know, sometimes you really get into the dirt when you're interviewing somebody. You're interviewing cops about murder and, you know, it can get pretty grisly. So what are you most proud of? And she said, I'm proud of them all, but I did interview a serial killer named Samuel Little once, and that was pretty cool. Or no, she arrested a serial killer named Sam Little once. I interviewed the serial killer. She caught him. But yeah, so she nailed a serial killer, and I was like, oh, I buried the lead here. I totally messed up this interview. And, you know, and then she told me a very brief story about this underreported serial killer that she apprehended in 2011. He was convicted finally in 2014 of three murders that they were able to connect through a Department of Justice grant that gave them funds to go back and test evidence. Like, if there were cold cases that looked like the evidence was promising, given the new DNA technology, you know, so they got three separate hits in LA for this man, Samuel Little. And then there was a countrywide manhunt for him. He was a transient. It's very hard to find. Finally got him. Then could they keep him? Right. You know, so it's very exciting story. All that you can find in the book. And then he had maintained his innocence always and since. And I just thought, what happened here? And why was this so underreported? And I began looking into it, and I could not believe this man's rap sheet. Like, it has staggered the most hardened of prosecutors. Like, he was in jail every other day of his life. He was, I mean, they had him for rape, assault, murder. He got off every time. But mostly it was petty theft or grand theft auto or, and so in any case, I was flabbergasted and thought, how could this have happened? And I started really learning about, the lack of interjurisdictional communication that has really hindered connecting crimes behaviorally for years in this country. And I thought, well, if I could use this guy, I could bring some attention to this issue. So if I could just write this hot piece about this serial killer, get some attention going, get some dialogue going, that was the end of what I thought I would get. But I thought, I'll get this guy talking. I'll get him admitting something. I'm really good at it.
Right.
My husband's best friend, we were out to dinner with his new girlfriend, and he says, be careful of her. She will have you admitting things that you didn't even do by the end of dinner.
That's right. That's starting to think of that. It's like, okay, so I want to dig into this. And then you're like, well, okay, I'm going to go talk to a serial killer. Like, it's like, we have great ideas all the time. And this obviously turned out to be an amazing idea that led to an amazing.
But who knew? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know he was going to start confessing. I mean, it took 6 months to get my visitor clearance. It's not that easy.
Oh yeah.
And during that whole time we were writing back and forth, and he was just writing this crap, his upside down case. He's just, this is what they all, I'm just an unlucky guy. Everyone who's ever been caught by DNA has said, I'm just an unlucky guy. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
This is, and women this is are, you. I'm an unlucky girl. Right.
Yeah, right.
But in Sam's case, that was always his story. And I was like, I'll give him a little while to start giving me something interesting. Let me get him in person. That's how I work best. And let's see what I can do. And I went first day, he stuck with his story. He wanted to talk about his family. He wanted to talk about my family, all this, Okay. Second day went back and I was like, if by the end of today, because these days were like marathon days, I had to get up at 4 a.m, drive out to the prison, wait in the line for 3 hours. I was like, I'm not doing it again. I'm just not going to throw good money after bad.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm missing my kid's soccer game today. And then he started confessing that second interview I had with him. And it was, it was like first one's free. Right.
Right. Yeah.
It was so cliche. It was like someone was dumping a bucket of water on my head. I don't know what your experience has been with this, but like when someone finally cracks and tells the truth, has been lying to your face, it is like so exhilarating. And then also followed by this, like, oh no, like now what do I have to listen to? What have I asked for?
And you got to hide it too. You got to keep the poker face, right? Because it's like,
yeah.
Oh, he finally opens up and you're just like, nailed it. But it's like, oh, that's very, you just got to,
right.
You're like, I didn't just win. I can't show my one.
It's, right. No, absolutely not.
Yeah. Because that would just extend the game, when you're sitting across from somebody and they finally open up, you're like, oh, I got you now. I got that hook. But you know,
well, that's the patience. That's where the patience comes. Where, like, what we were talking about is just like, I had this. I would come up with all these sort of visuals in my head of, you know, ways to remember things or things to do to not make a face, you know, like one of them, if I got upset or I felt like crying or something, I would let it fall out of my feet into the floor. I would just let like drop down, fall out of my feet into the floor and keep my face perfect, you know? And the other thing was, my mother was very, very well-mannered woman, is still a very well-mannered woman. And she always had me sit when I was little, you know, with my ankles crossed, knees tight together, like you can hold an aspirin between them, and keep your hands crossed in your lap. And I found myself like going to that position more often than not, because I was like, if you're squeezing an aspirin in between your knees, it's very easy to keep your face plastered, you know, like your attention somewhere else. Or I don't know, but those were just like tricks I came up with in the moment, because, you know, sometimes you do want to, I don't know. I mean, there were times that I could have crawled across that table and strangled him myself. Yeah, you know, just, when he was describing the last moments of these women's lives with this giggly sort of like almost girlish glee.
Your technique is, you know, throwing all that stress, just pushing it right into the ground. For me, it was always, when I'd feel myself getting amped up, I would always, I used to drive across I-10 going to Pensacola, Florida, and all the horse farms and stuff. And there was a nice stretch with a huge horse pasture in it. And I always pictured like some old cowboy, like leaned up against a fence post, just doing nothing but enjoying the field. And I put myself in that and just chill. And then it would take away all that, you know, that buck fever or whatever you're feeling when you're confronting somebody. It's funny that, but just pouring all that energy out into the floor, that would have to take some practice, especially just facing down what I can imagine had to be some of the most horrible conversations that any human can have. Cause
fascinating, horrible. I mean, you know, they were all those things. If it were just a show of horrors, for the amount of years I worked on this, you know, I also met law enforcement across the country, you know, who surprised me, you know, with their passion, you know, and ones who were incredibly disappointing, and others who were, you know, really looking to change the way their departments approach cold cases and marginalized women and the kind of victims that Sam chose, counting on the fact that society wouldn't care about them. So it wasn't always, and also it wasn't always horrible because of all those, like this whole world that was open up to me. And I sort of had a gratitude to Sam for that. You know, I met Hilda Nelson down in Pascagoula, Mississippi. I was in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Everyone I met there was like, have you figured out how to spell it yet?
Not even gonna try.
You know, and really saw and learned about a lot of things that I never would have otherwise. And also, you know, how many times in your life are you going to get to ask somebody, why didn't you bury the bodies?
Right.
And you know, I figured it might be a once in a lifetime kind of thing. As much as the media makes us think there are serial killers coming out of our ears, it's not really true. It's pretty rare.
Yeah. Serial killers on every corner and the world's burning down around us. It's like, okay, can we just have some good news for a second?
You know, I think aberrations are really interesting. And Sam's an aberration. And it's really important to keep that in mind. When people say, like, are you more scared now? You know, my husband works a lot out of town. He's a musician. I mean, I have three dogs and two kids. And I'm, you know, I'm here in the house, and I'm less scared now than I was. I just, you know, I learned when the fear like started to creep into my real life. I started to take some action, you know, and I started to box, and I learned some self-defense, and I got strong in my posture, you know, and I learned to use a gun, and I learned about awareness, and took a bunch of classes. And so I actually feel much safer now, the more informed I am.
Yeah. Just taking control of that, taking control of that situation. That's, that's amazing. Cause there's so many people who don't do that, which is very sad, that don't take advantage of the situation presented in front of them and take that proactive step to, you know, make yourself take the action to make yourself feel above that situation or able to control that situation. That's,
as best you can. I mean, yeah. You know, and then, other than that, life's a risk every time we put, you know, like step out the door. So, you know, and also being so close to the monster, for so long, you know, I felt like I'd seen him and he wasn't under my bed.
Right.
You know, like all these things that spooked me or scared me, or, you know, people are like, are you scared of scary movies? And I'm just like, seriously have a moment. I watch my email to like, just chill me out, you know?
Right. And it's funny. Yeah. Cause I mean, how often does any of us get to see that aspect of the world? Right. Like, I mean, ID Discovery is on millions of homes every single night, just showing the worst that humans can do to each other. But you're in that very rare position to have sat down in an open air environment. It was an open visiting area, right? There was no restraints. There was nothing keeping the two of you apart. And you get to see that aspect of a real world aberration, as you call it.
Oh yeah. You know, I put his hand on my arm. I put my hand on his arm. I gave him a hug. Hello. I mean, not immediately, but eventually. I was as surprised as you to hear that there, to see that there was no divider. I mean, I feel like I'd seen it 1,000 times on TV that I'd like been scammed or something. I expected the whole, I mean, he's a multiple murderer, you know, he's serving three consecutive life sentences. The only reason they didn't pursue the death penalty was he was 78 years old. It gets tangled in a tremendous amount of bureaucracy, and we don't kill people here in California. Yeah. So it's not worth it. You know, it wasn't worth it for the prosecution. Otherwise, I'm sure that best settlement would have. In any case, this multiple murderer, he was in a wheelchair. So he had like special, you know, he was in a block on just the main line, and he walked into it had to have like wheelchair access, I guess. Yeah. And so he didn't walk in, he rolled in.
I was gonna let that go.
into the family. Oh, but you know, believe me, he could stand up out of that wheelchair when he really wanted to, trust. I think a lot of that was he did have a toe removed from diabetes, but a lot of the wheelchair was to get him access, you know, there he was. Yeah. That's the manipulation. That's a sociopath. There it is.
Yeah. It's equated to the sweaters the Menendez brothers were put into for trial, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like, put that facade on to whatever you can get away with in that situation. And that was one of the things that I thought about in the beginning. I mean, with his experience, I just wondered, you know, the dynamics of the two of you when that relationship started. Was he, like you said, he's done with all his appeals. He can choose, because he's the one, I mean, he's not going anywhere, and he gets to decide how to spend his days. So does he think that this is this is entertaining. Let's see where this goes. Or he could have just been like, I don't think so. Yeah, he's just looking for a diversion, and it turned into what you've built out of this. It's amazing.
He wanted a friend. Yeah. You know, he was fresh out. Like I said, he was an underreported serial killer. And all they had was three. No one knew there were going to be 93 confessions, 63 of which are now confirmed, which makes him the most prolific serial killer in American history, according to the FBI. The proportions of this, no one had any idea. So, you know, when I walked in, I think he saw someone he could mess with. I think he saw somebody, I was very clear. I was writing a book, I was writing a book on violent behavior is how I opened up. Not like on the fact that I know you're a serial killer. Just admit it.
I'm here to write about you specifically.
that is what they want to hear eventually. Oh, yeah, but Texas Ranger James Holland, who was actually the sort of main person who got confessions out of him. It wasn't me. I'm a journalist. Also, I can't take official confessions.
Right.
What I can do, people are like, you got these confessions. I'm like, that's actually not how that works. What I can do, though, is if I feel like I have relevant information or details, I can go to law enforcement and say, here, I have this that I got in this interview, which Sam knew very well I was doing.
Question I had. Yeah.
When he started saying, are you working with the cops? I was like, Sam, this is going to be a book, which means that everyone gets to read it. So,
and they're recording you. They're recording us right now. There's cameras everywhere.
There's cameras. Yeah. Like these sheriff's deputy who got me in trouble one day once said, 19. I was like, what? 19 what? 19 what? I was like, 19 victims, 19 years old, 19 what? And she was like, 19 cameras. There are 19 cameras in there and I'm watching you.
Wow.
And I was like, okay.
Caught her on the wrong day.
I was sort of like, that's a little hot. I don't know what, but
you could have said that nicer.
Exactly.
When I asked if you disclosed that to him, because I mean, as a reporter, taking this information and then, it's just you can't call him a source because his reporting, he's already guilty of everything, but to maintain that trust. That's where I was going with it. How to keep in that relationship and being open.
I lied to him as little as possible. I would say that I lied to him more in my manner than I did in my in the actual statements I made. Because if I'm going to go in and lie to a psychopath, that's like me getting in the ring and boxing Muhammad Ali. It's just I'm playing their game and they're going to be better at it than I am because I actually do register emotion. I do have a conscience, not every single thing I do is transactional. My experience has been, they really do know what you think before you do. So, if you go in there thinking you're going to win or you're going to lie, I think you're setting yourself up for a fail. Like I walked in, my aunt, who I do have an ace in the hole. My aunt is a very famous psychiatrist, has been at Harvard and Mass General for 40 years. And she's a famous diagnostician. And she told me, talking to a psychopath is like a game of Jeopardy. All of the answers are questions and don't expect to win.
Wow.
And I was like, that's about as good as it gets of an explanation. So I didn't expect to win, but I was like, how much am I willing to lose?
Yeah.
Kind of a constant calculation.
Yep. And just maintaining that relationship over time to get that information. That's what always gets me is the relationship you know, maintaining that relationship when you're having discussions that are, well, I guess in this situation, I guess it wasn't against his best interest, but in, you know, you're talking about him admitting to things that are just atrocious to the rest of society. But, you know, in my mind, that's me trying to get a guy to confess so I can go forward with the prosecutorial process. But this guy, he's got nothing loose. So he was probably like, yeah, I might as well get my points. Right. I guess I was completely wrong in my thinking. Yeah.
But also, you know, like I might as well be famous. And he was very much like, he was very invested in certain details about how people perceive him, which also is not unusual amongst serial killers, you know, like I kill this kind of person, not that kind of person, right? You know? So, you know, his idea was,
Oh, that's all right.
What, will you bring me around to what I was talking about?
It was I had it backwards in my head, thinking, you know, that you'd be having conversations and stuff, him admitting to stuff that other people just have no interest in. But he's to the point now, he might as well climb as high up on that awful ladder as
possible. Exactly. Okay. So, sorry. I have a new puppy. So like when I hear the puppy baby screaming noise, I'm just like, what are they doing to him?
waiting for the crash to follow.
anyway, I'm sorry. Repeat the question again.
Yeah, sorry. I was speaking of the two of your dynamics, and you know, the maintaining that relationship of getting the information you want while he's made that decision of whether, you know, trying to get as much for himself. And I guess you were kind of leaning at that, him just trying to, the way he saw himself as a star in his own mind. And
I would say that our relationship went through different phases. It definitely progressed from the beginning, you know, where I was flattering him more. And, you know, it was a little bit more of a sort of vaudeville act between us. You know, he wanted me to sing him a song. If I sang him a song, he'd tell me a story, and things like that, you know, and he was just messing around. Everything was transactional for him. But, you know, the dynamics of the relationship shifted with those power dynamics, you know. Basically, you know, I was a well put together woman who would show up and visit him. He would say, you know, I was his fancy journalist that made him kind of a celebrity on the yard. Everyone wanted to know, you know, why are they writing about him? And then, you know, and then he began to play all the cops around him. And, you know, they were coming from all over the country, bringing him oranges from Florida and barbecue from Kentucky. And he was having a grand old time confessing, really. Then, you know, he would pitch a fit. He would demand to speak to me, things like that. You know, I went down to Texas twice to see him during his confessions. You know, like I feel like more than I was the confessor, I was like, I encouraged him to keep going. And I would say things to him like, Sam, I know that you're telling these people that you care about the families, you have remorse. I know that's not true. But I know this, that you care about me. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Like, he cared about me because I was writing a book about him. He cared about me because, you know, I made sure there was money on his book so he'd get his ramen. You know, he cared about me because I promised he would not die alone if he gave me this exclusive interview, you know?
Yeah.
I'll be your friend till the day you die. But, you know, then he would, when I was working on the documentary, Confronting a Serial Killer, streaming everywhere now, not Netflix, everywhere else. which shows a lot of these conversations, you know, there, I was taking calls from him every day. And if I didn't pick up a call, you know, where are you? And start to do that sort of cracked, jealous, psycho persona, which was really not fun. So it became like the manipulation went beyond like the time that we were conversing and just sort of started to take over my whole life.
Yeah, trying to keep that control, trying to take control. It makes me wonder.
And also it's like, I couldn't walk around my own house. I couldn't go outside with my dogs. I couldn't like, you know, just like walk out on my porch because leave my phone behind because God forbid he called. And I started to walk everywhere in my house with a crossbody bag that just had, you know, my reporter's notebook, my phone and my recorder in it. And I was like, it's like being held hostage in a way. I mean, that's obviously a metaphor.
Yeah, but what they do is try to keep control. And I was wondering, as you were talking, you know, you laid it out when you were building your relationship, you kind of put on the show for them and work your way in. But at some point you did have to call them out. Like the first time how hard did you have to weigh, like, you know, when you see him going down his path and he's playing his game, but it gets to the point where you can't let him play his game anymore. And you got to kind of flip it on him or call him on his nonsense a little bit. When that instant happened, were you a little bit like, oh, he's going to pitch a fit and it's all going to blow up? Were you a little afraid that you were just going to hit that edge?
Well, you know, I started to push at different times. Like there were times that I thought I'd never see him again. There were times I thought he was going to die. You know, that I would feel a little more motivation to go for the jugular. And I got more myself with him as we went on and did begin to call him on stuff, and he would laugh and say, you know, that's my smart baby. You got the psychology. Oof. You know, like patronizing and, you know, but also, I mean, he did know, you know, I am smart, and I was the right person to tell his story. You know, I think the book is so rich. There's so much in there. And it goes, you know, in depth into the making of a serial killer and the breaking of one.
Yeah, and there's so much into that, but it's one of those things where you mentioned it a little while ago, how he was, you know, when it breaks out and when all the investigators are starting to come in and he's just having such a great time profiting off of the evil things that he did. Mm-hmm. You mentioned it earlier, kind of when you look at what he did is an indictment. And I think we should talk about the victimization, you know, and on different levels, you know, on several different levels, but his entire ability to do what he did. And even after he got caught, it's an indictment on society. I mean, you mentioned, you know, marginalized female victims, at points there's those great investigators that have no idea that the clock stops at any time. They don't care what the pay is. They just know that somebody needs to speak for this victim and somebody needs to pay for it. And then you got the other investigators who, where it's a no human impact, no humans involved.
Particular, I don't know how national it was, but within the LAPD, it was like code that they would use in the 80s when, you know, women were turning up dead in dumpsters all over South LA, you know. I mean, every morning someone was turning up dead, and they would say, you know, it's a 187, it's a homicide on 5th and Main. There's no humans involved in NHI.
Yeah.
Like a homicide without a human involved, you know, or they would just say it's a no one.
It's a no one. And that's what I meant with, I mean, you did this all the way across the country And the fact that there was no, you know, who was the, you know, the obsession that we had a couple of years ago with Gabby, what's her name, from Florida, who ended up in Utah and a domestic and was let go. And the entire country was, here's a little blonde white girl who's, something's happened and the entire country is just so focused. But look at what he was able to do, and the women, it's the demographic that he took, there was not enough community, societal. And it's, this isn't blaming, you know, there's blame for the authorities. There's blame for the justice system. There's blame for the communities, because the communities don't care. Right.
Absolutely. So well, you know, I mean, lays he was it open. Acquitted by a jury of his peers.
Yeah. Yeah.
More than once. There was a failure to indict by a grand jury. You know, I had cops in Mississippi say to me, you just couldn't commit a crime against a black prostitute in Pascagoula, Mississippi in the 80s. It was not considered a crime, you know, and yes, that's us. That's not just the cops, you know, like Robert Kennedy, the good one, the first one, said, you know, every society gets the criminal it deserves and the law enforcement it demands. And I think that, you know, like, to look at the law enforcement and just place the blame on them, it's like they're the only racists around, you know, who don't consider women who are of color, prostitutes, marginalized, you know, often victims of violence, drug addicts, that it's just the police that don't consider these people less human to begin with. I mean, like you're saying, investigation discovery, you'll find a dead white girl on there any night of the week, you know, and that's what the less dead and more dead idea is about, which is a criminology concept that, you know, there are people in society who are less dead when they die because they were less human. They were considered less human when they were alive. So like the governor's daughter who goes missing on spring break is the most dead. And, you know, a prostitute struggling with addiction in South LA, you know, a woman of color, you know, and without resources is the least dead.
Yep. And it's just as you know, as you're just looking at what he did, that scope just shows from literally coast to coast, the community focus on the betterment of their most downtrodden has never been the priority. It's still not the priority. I mean, there's a lot more focus on it today. There's a lot more victims programs. There's a lot more outreach. But if you go, like you said, jury of their peers, if you walk into any given community where you have that demographic on the, you know, underpinnings, it doesn't matter who they are. They're not going to acknowledge them. They're not going to stop to, there's no community outreach trying to clean up the streets. And it's just like like you said, that Kennedy quote, it's harsh, but I think this case in this book is such a spotlight on just having our society look in the mirror and say, you know, you allowed this. Mm-hmm. It was all of us that allowed people like this to flourish for 60 years.
I think it's so important that you point that out. And you know, I think that these stories, I always aim to entertain, you know, I'm going to tell you the most captivating story I can to get you interested in, you know, whatever I'm trying to tell you. I've never gotten this, nothing's gotten a hook in me quite like this that I've ever worked on before. And I have never felt so passionate about just sort of exactly as you're saying, like inviting everyone into this dialogue. Yeah. Like it's not just like you haven't escaped this problem. Because even if you've escaped this problem, you live in some gated community and, you know, like you're not the only one here.
And we're responsible.
Yes, we are responsible. I always have my press pass, which drives my husband nuts. But I see police, they pulled over my neighborhood, whatever. I go and I'm like, hi, I'm a neighbor. I'm also press. I'm here to see what's going on. You know, like I want to know what's going on with crime in my community. And they're like, no comment. There she is again. No comment. I'm like, come on, guys.
I think the next question would be, how do you fix that? But I don't see momentum or willingness for us as a community to look in that mirror and say something's wrong. It's
interesting because what I've been getting, going to these, stops, they put in a community of tiny houses. And I know my neighbors, like many of them have had houses here for 40 years. Many of them grew up here. It's a very sort of unusual little suburban enclave in LA. And they don't really see anything other than criminals and addicts living on their corner. I'd really like to give it a chance to breathe and see if there are social programs available here. Is there a way, they live here already? They're part of our community.
Yeah. And we're okay with turning our backs on them because I can watch the news and say, somebody should do something, And it's like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, it's not me. I'm just saying somebody should do something.
Somebody should do something, And also, defund this and defund that.
I think there's targeted places where their resources could be poured, but there's, if we just started with mental health and you just walk down any given street in America and you just watch people and you can see they're not okay. But there's government has no interest cities have no interest. They're like, they're doing what they do. It's like, what they're doing is they're circling the drain and they don't even know there's a drain. It's a problem.
And it's about humanism, but things have become so greedy and so specialized. I even called my friend about another science piece I was writing, and I said I called the people at Caltech where Einstein and Richard Feynman used to be, and I said to him, where are your humanists these days? Who's your great humanist? Who's your famous humanist? And he said, we don't have one. He's like, do you want to talk to the humanities department? I think we have a humanities department somewhere. I'm like, what? It's shoved in the basement behind Einstein's doodles. Humanism, this caring about other humans. Basic empathy. So, I hope that by, the attempts that I make to give the victims in this story their voices, it's another place that I really dig into that I think you don't see a lot in books about serial killers, or it's weighted heavily one way or the other, is that, I'm looking at these victims' lives and trying to look at the restoration of justice. And while for some that may never happen, humanize them and try to give them back their names or invite other people into the search as well.
There's nobody speaking. They can't speak for themselves. And it's so easy to fall into a file folder. And everybody has a story. And that's what always has gotten me is just the fact that a victim could fall into the dustbin and, they had a story regardless of how great that story was. They still had a story, and, the system's not built to go backwards. Like you've said that they don't pour resources into cold cases. They, even though the technology has done amazing things and we've seen it do amazing things over these past couple of years, But the willingness and the ability to spend resources to go back and actually find a voice for those victims, it's so important when, like you said, that you put the narrative, sure, we've got to talk about this monster, but
right.
we can also talk about the people that he took away, the people who meant something to somebody, yeah. you know, might have been, we can call them marginalized in society, but there's people who still miss them. And
absolutely. I mean, yeah. I'm still friends with the victims' families. For many of the victims, I did a deep dive, and the ripple effect of their deaths, and they had children and families who loved them, and whether they did or whether they didn't, there was we were talking about South Carolina, detective I talked to in South Carolina, and we were just in confidence saying, like, what do you think about the word closure? And he said, it's an easy thing to say to the press, but, I work for God's children. And it's there may be closure, there may be not. There may be a family member who shows up, there may be not, but I work for all God's children. And I was like, that's it.
You just want to mass market, mass produce that guy, right? And give him a badge.
Yeah.
Can we spread you around a little more?
Right.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's just
but to see though, and there's a lot of volunteer programs working cold cases with reserve officers. Mm-hmm. And what I would love to see is, I think they've been piloting some programs like this in the U.S. And I know that it works great in Canada using students. Like who could research and get credit for that research, students in forensics. We have like one of the greatest forensic labs here in LA at Cal State LA. And so that I think that, to be able to delegate some cold case work. I can't tell you how many hours I sat at the coroner's office and I was like, seriously. Like, because you have to kind of go to actually get them to get you the papers. Mm-hmm. Like, you can, otherwise you're writing them letters that I blank checks in them. I'm not joking. I was like, I have to put a blank check in this envelope and send it to like a bureaucrat in Florida. Okay. But I spent so much time at the LA County Coroner's Office. I was really good friends with the woman who owned the gift shop there. But yeah, I know they did. They had office. A great gift shop, but they closed it down. But I was like, can you just let me, there's no one here alive.
Yeah.
Like I can do no damage here. Yeah, like no one's going through these boxes anyway. Or just let me back there. And so I would like to sort of look into how I could contribute to sort of fostering these, exploring how these programs could work.
Well, and it would just send the right message. I mean, if we're talking interns with an interest in cold case files, we're talking interns who hope to carry a badge and are sworn one day, and right. an experience running cold cases would instill the victim first mentality in every one of them. Cause they're going to be affected by what they read. It's right. going to happen, and they're going to feel the fulfillment when they get that hit,
right.
And I had, speaking of civic organizations, I had Margaret Press from DNA Doe on mm-hmm. probably during the summer. And she just got together with a friend of hers one day and was like, I do genealogy and we have DNA. And they just started putting DNA and genealogy together to identify Jane Doe. Doesn't even have to be a criminal. Missing persons, mm-hmm. it's putting a name to them. And she's been incredibly successful. And she was just, it's civic duty, just a normal American just saying, I can do this and I can make
right.
an impact.
Yeah.
But yeah, we always, we look at the interns as that's easy, cheap forced labor. It's like, come on, you need to do an intern thing at college anyway. Why don't we go clear out some of these cases?
Exactly. And I think that it would be, there's a lot of passion, they're hungry, they're passionate.
And we've still got the idealism is just dripping off them.
Yes.
Right.
So it's perfect for cold cases. Need it. You need a lot of it.
Yep. Yeah. No, I love the idea of working cold cases. And I see that we've been going about an hour now, but one of the last things I wanted to ask you about, and it's still It's related, but it's more about you. And if you don't want to answer, that's fine. But the stress of holding those interviews, I mean, you've talked about, you know, selling certain points and making gains and facing losses. But when you would leave these conversations, like when you walked out the out back in the prison yard and you're in the parking lot, was it either some days you feel like a spike in the football and other days you feel like you just had a mountain dropped on you, like the stress of dealing with all this?
I put every single thing out of my head other than what he had told me, because you cannot bring a recording device into a prison in California, not since Manson. Ruined it for all of us.
Ruined it for everybody.
ruined pretty much ruined the whole 60s. Ruined everything. But definitely ruined recording in prisons, because, you know, he was such a mass media circus. So I had to remember. I did it all by memory. So I just went to like the nearest restaurant that had a glass of wine and a salad. And I would sit there for like 3 hours and just write every single thing he had told me. Now, I'm a poker player, and I grew up, my father's a professional gambler. And so he'd been teaching me memory tricks my whole life. So I was able to like use these memory tricks. I mean, I always have, but I use a memory palace. Using a memory palace for, you know, a 10-minute conversation and for a 3-hour conversation are two very different things that involve like details. So, I mean, it was like lifting weights.
Oh, I can imagine.
Definitely got ready for it. And then,
I just wonder, that's heavy. That's a lot of heavy stuff that, to deal with and to not be able to take notes.
But then after,
like that.
So it was like, I just felt like I was like dead. I mean, there's one day that I did scream in the parking lot, but, or on the side of the road on my way out of the parking lot. But, for the most part, I was just like, I flatlined it. Like I kept it so, focused. And I mean, you know, it's one of the most exhausting things I've ever done to keep that focus for that long, but I did. And then I would just write down everything, you know, one thing after another. And then I could have all my feelings on the way home and, you know, sing along to Oasis or whatever and cry.
Yeah. Just work it out.
You know, like there was work to be done.
Yeah.
It wasn't about my feelings. It wasn't about my big feelings. And that was very clear to me.
That's what I was wondering. It's just, and now I'm having a brain fart. Not just, you know, being able to work through that information. And I mean, honestly, sitting down, glass of wine, and just whipping all that stuff out there, it's got to be cathartic because it's finally gone, right? And I guess you're compartmentalizing those pieces. So yeah,
it's never gone, but what it did was it allowed me to put it down for a moment.
Yeah.
Like I didn't have to then take that home into my, like walk into my family having dinner, because that's essentially what I did every Saturday and Sunday, and bring that all in. You know, it was like, I was like, it's down on paper. It's down there. I could put it aside for a second.
Yeah.
I don't
work
have
starts
to be,
back tomorrow. Yeah.
But I don't have to be churning it. Now that sometimes worked and sometimes didn't, but more often than not, we're still here. So.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the amount
it's
of good you've
families.
Done. Yeah. And the amount of good you've done for those, the people associated with those victims is I think is such a payoff, but thank you for the work you've done. And
thank you for saying that. And, you know, I mean, the payoff has been all the things I need. You're right. Mm-hmm. It has been incredibly gratifying.
That's good. Well, I told you I wouldn't keep you much more than an hour, and I feel like we could probably go till midnight. So I'll let you go. And before I go, your website and socials.
At JillianLauren.com. And my TikTok, I am doing a TikTok now. is Jillian Lauren Author. My Instagram is Jillian Lauren. And there you go.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Jillian.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Good night, everybody.